You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
May 17th marked the 60th anniversary of the Supreme Court's historic decision, Brown versus Board of Education, that abolished separate but equal schools in the United States. In the years that followed through to the late 1980s, schools became more diverse and less segregated, but for some 25 years, that trend has gone into reverse. In a two-part documentary from PBS Frontline, Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer look at education, class, and race since the desegregation decision. In their film's first part, Separate and Unequal, they report on efforts to form a new city and school in East Baton Rouge Parish, Louisiana. In the second part, Omarina's story, they follow up on a Bronx student whose story was first told on Frontline 2 years ago. Separate and Unequal airs on Tuesday evening. It's tomorrow night. I'm very pleased that it brings Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What's happening in East Baton Rouge Parish? How do Baton Rouge or Louisiana public schools compare with others across the United States?
That's a very good question. Well, we were drawn to the film because of the sort of strength and vigor of the controversy in Baton Rouge. There we see a group of parents and citizens, businessmen, who are dissatisfied with the quality of their local schools and are trying to form their own city and their own school district. Because they believe this will ultimately provide them with better schools and better opportunities for their children. Their opponents, however, say that the consequence of this proposed city and district would be a worsening or deepening of segregation along class lines and race lines.
Are groups in other parts of the country trying to do something similar, split up towns to form new school districts?
Yes. One of the things that also draws to the film was that it was an opportunity to explore a larger issue and a larger national trend. Around the country, in the last couple of years, we've seen lots of districts, some of them in the South, in Tennessee, some movement in Florida, Texas, to have smaller, mostly white, mostly middle-class communities separate, often from their inner city or just rural, poor communities.
So this is not just happening in urban areas?
It happens a lot with districts that line urban districts. In southern cities, it's districts that have come on and looped into urban districts, and now they want to leave. But in other instances, it's districts that were never in the Atlanta area where you're seeing some of this movement. These are districts that were never inside the city limits, but they're aligned with poor rural communities. They want out of those.
What justification do the advocates of separation cite for forming new districts?
I would say that, simply put, they cite the poor quality of the district that they are leaving. They say that they have been patient, that they have provided the district with ample patience and support. They have been promised change, and the district has failed to deliver on that change through many, many administrations.
Haven't they been accused of engaging in a form of racism? Is there any legitimacy to their concerns?
It's a very provocative question, and perhaps it's one of the questions at the heart of the film. We interview Professor Gary Orfield from UCLA in the film, distinguished expert who heads the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. And Gary says, you know, quite interestingly, that individuals who take actions that perhaps impact one race disproportionately don't necessarily do so with racist intentions, but the impact can be considered to, again, impact one race disproportionately.
Is anybody in the area referring to this movement as resegregation?
There is a lot of discussion about that. One of the people that we also interview in the film is a mother, Belinda Davis, who has led up a kind of counter movement and has urged these parents to stop trying to move away and to actually come and try to improve the schools from within.
She's a white mother.
She is a white mother. And she really believes that what this is an attempt to isolate poor kids of color and to separate them from these wealthier kids.
Race was the motivation for segregation up till 1954. Today, some talk about the end of race. What role do the people you've talked with think of that race is playing here?
That's a great question. I would say that today segregation by race is very strongly correlated with or related to segregation by class and income.
And so in the end, because minorities tend to make less money, they wind up being segregated, whether that's the actual plan or not.
I think that's...
Yeah, and one of the things that Gary Orfield from the Civil Rights Project talks about is the kind of double whammy that a lot of these kids face. They're kids of color. They face the kinds of issues that that come with that. And then they face this issue of being low income and at risk in that way.
60 years ago, the law explicitly kept people separate. New laws today don't explicitly discriminate on the basis of race, but are laws being enacted that effectively discriminate?
Yes, in fact, they do. One of the things that happened, and Gary Orfield talked to us and talked in the film quite a bit about, is a kind of carving away of some of that wonderful attempts to integrate students with the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling. So after that, in the 90s, you started to see a Supreme Court that began to suggest that perhaps we were post-racial. They were a series of rulings that said, hey, you know, we can't do this anymore. We can't assign kids to schools based on race. It's actually racist in another sort of way. Then what we found in 2007 was a seminal ruling, which some folks consider just absolutely tragic, that said, no, absolutely, schools can no longer be assigned students based on race. It's not right to do it anymore.
But going all the way back to the first Supreme Court decision in 1954, Thurgood Marshall, who had argued Brown versus Board for the NAACP, predicted school segregation would be a thing of the past in 5 years. Mm-hmm. Did anybody believe that except Marshall? After all, the decision ordered desegregation, quote, with all deliberate speed, which was usually interpreted to mean not immediately.
Right. You know, Gary Orfield, again, has some very poignant remarks on Brown versus Board of Education, and he said that it's regarded around the world as a noble decision. It was a unanimous decision. The rhetoric is embraced around the world. However, when it came to actually describing how this change was going to be implemented, the decision fell short.
And George Wallace made his Segregation Now, Segregation Tomorrow, Segregation Forever speech in 1963, 9 years after Brown versus Board.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that happened with Brown versus Board of Ed is that it never really told anybody how to do this. And that, I think, we all understand today as was one of its biggest problems. There was a ruling that came down a couple of years after that that was more specifically told districts how they could desegregate. The problem, I think, that we all look at see now is that this was the folks that were supposed to do the desegregating were on district levels. They were on local levels. So particularly in the South, a lot of these folks that were actually there to implement these desegregation plans were actually opposed to desegregation. And so they didn't do it, or they kind of mucked around but sort of made sure it didn't happen. And that went on for years.
And then, of course, one of the things that happened with integration was white flight, parents taking their kids out of the public schools and putting them in private schools. So many of these towns, which have white majority population, have white minority school populations.
That's absolutely true. The Civil Rights Project at UCLA says that our public school system has lost 30% of its white population since the civil rights era. And as you mentioned, in Baton Rouge is case in point, where there is a white majority by a small amount in the parish, but there's only 11% of the white population that's in that public school system.
And they're concerned that they're paying a disproportionate amount as a result to keep the schools good, if they are being kept good. My guests are Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer. The two-part show, Separate and Unequal, will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS stations around the country. You interviewed a mother named Nikki Dangerfield. Could you tell us about her and the schooling issues she faces?
Sure. Nikki opens our film, and Nikki is a single mother in Baton Rouge. She has four children. Her oldest was the valedictorian of her high school class and now has an ROTC scholarship to Louisiana State University. Her three young boys are all in middle schools in the public school system, and they're each attending a school that serves their distinct needs. Her oldest boy is in a gifted and talented program. Her youngest boy loves the arts. He's quite dramatic naturally and is in a wonderful magnet school, by all accounts a wonderful magnet school that caters to his needs. Her children get up very early in the morning to ride buses to attend these specialized programs, you know, to reach these specialized programs and attend these schools. And she feels that while the public school system may not be perfect, that it ultimately benefits her children.
She says that she can't afford to pay for schooling for her kids. Is she implying that she would send them to private schools if she could afford to?
That's a very interesting.
I'm not sure if she would send them to private school, but I think that one of the key things that she will tell us is that the busing effort in Baton Rouge, her ability to move the kids around the district, which is one of the things the breakaway folks have been most critical of, is what has really saved her and her kids.
Since the wealthier white residents have pulled their kids from public schools, they have an incentive to lower funding for public schools and get tax cuts. Is money behind all of this? Or how much is money behind all of this is, I guess, the more correct question.
Money is at the center of the debate without question. And the dollars are debated. There's a war of fact on the ground. Absolutely, undeniably, both sides disagree about how much money will be left to spend on each student should this breakaway come to pass.
Some of the arguments that we're hearing, we've been hearing all along. For example, people don't want their kids bussed out of their neighborhoods. They remember the good old days when they could walk to school. They feel that integration has led to poorer education. Are these valid arguments?
Well, I think that one thing that you do know, we all know, is that one of the things that happened with the attempt to integrate schools because of American housing patterns, the fact that Americans tend to live in segregated communities, that there had to be busing. There had to be a lot of busing. And that is one of the things that has kind of exhausted these middle-class parents, in large part because at one point they say, and I think to some extent they were probably right, their local community school right next to their house was really good. So they had to get on a bus and send their kids far away to a potentially not as good school.
They're seeking to form a new city. How would that address the problems that they perceive?
Well, if they form this new city, there'll be a pocket of schools that used to be part of the East Baton Rouge Parish School District, which will now be part of their own school district, and they'll have a lot more power to assign students to the school next door.
Did the leaders of the movement to form a new city all have children in the public schools? Do they see this an opportunity for them to have a new city and all the other benefits that that might present?
Interestingly, most of the leaders of the St. George movement, as it's called, do not have children in the public school system.
They seem to be just as outraged as if they did.
Yes. The movement's leaders, one of them is a state senator, one of them is a local business leader. The local business leader has grandchildren who he would like to see in the public school system. His daughter, however, moved outside of the district because she believed that the educational opportunities for her children would be better elsewhere.
Are the schools in Baton Rouge performing poorly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we look at the schools in Baton Rouge and we see a lot of poverty pocket schools. We see what Gary Orfield describes as apartheid schools, not high performers. The state has taken six of the schools, more than six, I think, at this point, over. I think we discovered that over 40% of the schools in the district received a D or an F from the state. But we also saw some really wonderful schools, magnet schools, schools that were draw kids from across the district, often themed schools, some of the schools that Nikki Dangerfield, that lovely mother that we interviewed, has sent her kids to. Those were, Mary and I went down there and saw incredible schools.
Would just putting more money into improving performance be an answer?
The district likes to point to the progress they've made over the last 2 years. They've risen their score some 25 points. They point to these theme schools or magnet schools as examples of success. They say they know how to do it, and they're going to do more of it if you give them the chance.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about New York schools in the light of this conversation. My guests are Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer. Their documentaries put together, Separate and Unequal, deal with a situation in East Baton Rouge Parish, Louisiana, but also in New York. We'll be back right after this. We are back with Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer. Their films, Separate and Unequal, and Omarina Story, will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS's Frontline series. Did you separate responsibilities in putting these two films together?
Mm-hmm. Kyle and I worked together to produce Separate and Unequal. Kyle is a distinguished reporter with the New York Times and other outlets and originated the story. And then we worked together on the producing, and I functioned as the director and writer as well.
A caller, Bob from Rego Park, asks how you would recommend integrating New York City schools in school students in school systems today, when so many schools struggle with socioeconomic disparity and those differences are palpable in both private and public schools?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question. I think, first of all, many New Yorkers were sort of shocked to learn that in this integration issue that we have been such a culprit, the New York City public school system. To integrate schools, I think the first thing that is pretty clear is that it's very hard to do this involuntarily. Busing students involuntarily was tried. It doesn't work. Parents don't like it, and they ultimately flee the school district if they have to.
And this is not just white parents. This is across the board.
Across the board, yeah. I have been toying with this, thinking about this quite a bit. I have kids in the public school system myself. And I think that what we might need to do is to really form some sort of program that's voluntary. We have some excellent public schools, many of them in New York City, and they are it's really a privilege to be able to send a child to one of those schools. They tend to be in upper middle class neighborhoods. We have PS6, PS41. We've got schools in Brooklyn that are fabulous. And I think that one thing that we might start to see parents doing in those schools is to say, let us voluntarily open up some seats for kids who don't live in the neighborhood. And there are a lot of very active PTAs and a lot of active principals that understand the inequality here, and I think that is one possible solution.
Charter schools have been proposed as a possible solution. Isn't that Bobby Jindal's position in Louisiana, that there should be more charter schools rather than the state helping schools like the ones in Baton Rouge?
Yes, that's definitely a solution to sort of poor-performing schools. The problem is that, and this is something that we've come to understand in New York City, but that Gary Orfield noted around the country, the vast majority of charter schools are majority-minority. They're not places, they're not pockets of integration.
Mary, Frontline first met one Bronx student, Omarina Cabrera, a few years ago when she was in middle school. When did you first meet her, and what grade was she in then?
We met Omarina Cabrera in 2012 when she was in eighth grade. She was finishing up her middle school term at Middle School 244 in the Bronx, which is not a magnet school and it's not a charter school. It's a regular old public school.
How does it perform?
The school does very well, and they are, at the time, they were experimenting with a groundbreaking program coming out of Johns Hopkins University that enabled them to track their students' performance in some key classes and as well their attendance and determine which students were most likely to drop out of high school years later. And they could identify those kids in eighth grade and provide them with targeted intervention.
Does her story reflect possible problems of resegregation?
I don't know that I think it does necessarily. I think that she receives a quality education in an integrated environment.
Let's take a call from Bernie from Rockville Center. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a former teacher in the New York City school system. I also went to a public school bordering Coney Island and Brighton Beach. And the issue that very few people are willing to talk about is the following, and I'm very sympathetic to the idea of integrating the schools, but I taught in a school that was predominantly black in Brooklyn. The amount of violence and disruption by students that have all kinds of pathology at home was incredible. It was a constant struggle to teach. The administration said it was powerless to really do much with the disruptive students. And the few white and Asian students that were in the school were frequently harassed and beaten up, mugged for their lunch money. And as a parent, I mean, I can understand that if you're middle class and your child is integrated into a school where that's an element, as liberal as you may be, as a parent, you don't want to put your child in that situation. And unfortunately, that often is the situation in schools that are predominantly black.
Thank you for calling us, Bernie. You want to respond?
Sure. I think it's an interesting point because we discovered that the school that we decided to highlight in Baton Rouge was Woodlawn High School, a very large, at this point, very integrated school. And the biggest complaint that parents who want this school to separate because of what has happened to the school is the behavioral issues. They refer to them as behavioral issues in the school. I think that's a real problem, and I think it's one that you also hear in New York City with parents complaining about.
Well, didn't Omarina have behavioral issues? She had a busing problem of a different sort, mm-hmm. Because her home life was so unstable. Mm-hmm. She had to make a couple of changes on trains and buses every day. And it was a reason she was often late or didn't go to school at all.
That's absolutely the case. Yeah, Omarina was struggling with a home life that sort of pulled her away from school rather than sort of buttressing and supporting her experience at school. And it was then incumbent upon the school to supplant what she wasn't receiving at home. And they did that, and they did that very effectively.
So the one of the answers is programs like the one we see in this middle school?
I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that perhaps you can look at the two stories in tandem and see that one of them might perhaps suggest some solutions.
Has the program eliminated the kinds of behavioral problems that Bernie was talking about and that the people in Baton Rouge and I'm sure many other people have been concerned about?
You know, I think we'd be hard-pressed to find some objective means of measuring that, but I think that the school is performing very well and the students feel safe in the school.
Isn't Omarina an example of how potentially very good students can suffer for a host of reasons that do not lie in the schools that they're attending?
I think that's absolutely the case. Absolutely the case. Omarina is a motivated and inquisitive young woman who was somewhat limited or hamstrung by her experiences at home.
But then she wound up having the opportunity to apply to private schools because she improved her grades. What led to the change?
She did. She received what our expert in the film, Mr. Bell fans, would call an adult shepherd. She received the continuous and constant nurturing and nagging of an adult. And that adult paid attention to small things like how she was getting to school, whether she had the books that she needed.
Can school systems for the luxury of having adults like the one Omarina had for every troubled kid?
It's a great...
Or every kid with potential who is not who is underperforming?
It's a great question, and it differs from school to school. At Middle School 244 in the Bronx, they were able to meet their students' needs by redistributing their counselors. They were able to do it without increasing their budget. Now, I don't think that is necessarily the case for every school, but they did find a way to do it without a terrific expenditure.
Still, Omarina decided to leave the public school system when she could. She goes to a private school, a religious school called Brooks School, which is just a few miles from Phillips Academy, which is a very famous, wealthy private school. How diverse is Brooks?
Brooks makes a great effort to maintain some diversity in their population, but nonetheless, she went from a school where minorities were the majority to where minorities were the minority, and there was quite a culture shock.
And was she able to adjust easily? Were the kids able to adjust to her easily?
There was an adjustment period. There was a period of struggle, absolutely. She talks in the film about how she came across questions like, were you born here, or do you think in Spanish, or how do you do your hair? And she's very sympathetic and generous towards those who make these remarks towards her and say, you know, they're asking because they don't know and they're genuinely curious, and I'm happy I can provide them with answers.
Whereas some other kids might find them offensive and be filled with resentment.
Yeah.
My guests are Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer. Their films, Separate and Unequal and Omarina's Story, will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS as part of the Frontline series. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Omarina has two brothers. Her twin, Omarlin, was having trouble with attendance and hanging out in the streets. And he's the opposite. His story is almost the total opposite of his twins.
You know, the story of these two twins, Omarina and Omarlin, is both remarkably uplifting and terrifically sad as well. One of these twins is faring very, very well. Omarina is thriving by all accounts, and Omarlin is not. And it's very hard to watch this fork in the road widen.
Do you think that if O'Marlin had entered a school like Brooks, he's a young black male, that he might get a different kind of reception?
That's a very provocative question. I imagine that he might. He is a different person. He's not Omarina exactly, despite them sharing some genes.
But he seems bright and presentable.
He tested very, very well early on. Omarina always says he's smarter than me. He's smarter than me.
What about the second brother who doesn't get mentioned in the film?
Yeah, the family sort of preferred that we keep our distance from the older brother. But he's met with some trouble as well.
Omarina was a very good student before she started to experience trouble. What happens to average students or students who don't get special attention? An average student might not have a positive a story, even if she applied herself in the way Omarina did.
Omarina is, by all accounts, remarkable. You see the program that the school has implemented, that Middle School 244 has implemented, working for students who have a range of aptitudes, however. So I think what the school is able to do is sort of to lift every individual to the best of their natural abilities. And not every student is going to end up with a full scholarship to Brooks School, but they help place their students in the high schools that serve them best.
The story of Omarina and that frontline segment, the first one and then this one, dealt with high school dropout rates. Separate and Unequal deals with resegregation. What connection, if any, do you see between the two issues of dropout rates and resegregation?
Well, I think one of the things that you'll find is that in schools that are low-income schools, in low-income neighborhoods, the dropout rate is higher. And one of the things that we came to understand when we were doing this film is that it can be very, very beneficial for low-income students to be around middle-class students and their parents, which is one of the reasons why economic and racial integration is so important.
But is a school like MS 244, which is largely poor and students of color, is that an example of separate and unequal in the United States today?
That's a very provocative question. I think Middle School 244 may be separate, but it provides a quality educational experience.
Is this just because it has a good principal?
That principal deserves a tremendous amount of credit. She creates a culture of excellence within that school. From the day the kids enter, they're hearing about college, they're learning about college. There is no doubt that she expects every student in that school to go on to college.
The Bronx borders on Westchester. They are practically opposite in terms of wealth, school graduation rates, and ethnic composition. Are New York City and bordering areas already segregated along economic lines and racial lines?
Yeah, I think we know that. And I think what is really so tragic is that a lot of middle-class parents who send their kids to the public schools are very proud of that. I've bought into the public school system. I'm in the public school system. But the reality is that when they send their children to schools that are all white or mostly middle-class, they are actually contributing to a divide that is turning out to be quite detrimental for children at risk.
The Hispanic population in the United States is growing rapidly. Are public schools segregated for Hispanics as well?
Yes. Our numbers suggested that as more and more Hispanic students have come into the system, they have become just as segregated. And in some cases, school districts we've seen have done something sort of tragic, which is to gerrymander in gerrymander out Hispanic neighborhoods and make sure those kids do not come into upper middle class white schools.
Is language a factor in resegregation?
Well, I think that one of the things that we all know is that when you have lots of kids who are struggling with English, that's more resources, that's more money, that's more teaching that needs to go towards that.
If people of different ethnicities choose to live in areas that look familiar with people whom they see as being like themselves, how can their choices be judged one way or another?
I think one of the questions that Separate and Unequal raises is whether or not we're asking and expecting our government to help us cross the lines that we establish with our housing choices.
So housing is also a way of dealing with this. Julie from the Bronx asks, Mayor de Blasio has this idea of mixed housing where lower income, middle income, and upper income residents coexist. Could a similar program work in school systems? First of all, could a system like that work in housing, considering the fact that there's often resistance to having mixed housing in areas, in many areas.
Well, one of the things that has come out of that 2007 Supreme Court ruling, which said you can no longer, it's unconstitutional to assign students by race, is a very important discussion about whether we ought to be assigning students by their income, by their parents' income. And Richard Kallenberg at the Century Foundation, who's been a wonderful advocate of this particular type of parceling out of students, would like to see more of that. Some of it with magnet schools and some of it just with district schools.
We're going to take one more call. We're fast running out of time. But Peter from Manhattan, you're on the air. You disagree with Bernie, the previous caller?
Yes, I absolutely do. In that I've taught in New York City public schools, predominantly black, and I've also taught in Long Island. I've had the similar problems in terms of behavioral issues. Your guest didn't provide a context in their response. There's a whole range of factors. And as a teacher, you're there to provide reinforcement, guidance, and support for your students and not to be critical of them. It seems to me that this person that called has some other issues that is prompting him to make a blanket statement without providing a context for his remarks.
Well, thank you for calling us and correcting that. Just one other point I want to mention before we end this conversation. The NAACP reports that nationwide about 4% of white students attend high-poverty schools, while 33% of African-American students do. So should we be focusing on race or should we be focusing on economic inequalities?
I think they're so linked that it's almost impossible not to look at them together. But again, because of this 2007 Supreme Court ruling, we cannot assign kids to schools based on their race, but we can assign them based on their income. So we should probably focus on that if we want integration.
Now, you try very hard in Separate and Unequal to not take sides. But I suspect that you do have personal opinions about how the situation in Baton Rouge should finally wind up developing.
We were drawn to this conversation and this issue because of its complexity, and we see our job as journalists and reporters to observe and to approach the subject matter with a tremendous amount of curiosity, inquisitiveness, and fairness.
Mary Robertson and Kyle Spencer, their film Separate and Unequal and Omarina's Story will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS as part of its Frontline series. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.